The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The following is a conversation between Glenn E. Martin, president and founder of Just Leadership USA, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
My next guest identifies himself as a formerly incarcerated criminal justice reform advocate. He believed that those who are closest to the problem are also closest to the solution, which is why he helps develop the leadership skills of the formerly incarcerated to reform a criminal justice system that he says is failing in just about every conceivable way. He is Glenn E. Martin, the founder and president of Just Leadership USA. Good evening, Glenn, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
I'm glad to be on the show. Thank you.
Give us a quick snapshot of Just Leadership USA and the mission of the organization.
Sure. So we have the goal of cutting the number of people under correctional supervision in this country in half by 2030. And we do that by investing in the leadership of formerly incarcerated people all across America as part of the solution to mass incarceration.
Well, back in, let's say, 1980, the prison population was about 500,000 people or so. Today, it's 2.3 million, and there are millions more under correctional supervision of one kind or another. Flesh out that picture a little bit for our listeners and tell us what in the world happened.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you started with 1980 because a lot of people don't realize that mass incarceration is a relatively recent phenomenon, although one might argue that this is a new iteration of some previous system of oppression in this country. But the fact that it's so young means that we can actually put our finger pretty concretely on the policy levers that we use to get here. Mandatory minimums, truth in sentencing, three strikes laws, prison privatization, and a number of others, which gives me hope that we can find ways to roll back our decision to criminalize things like homelessness and poverty and addiction and mental health and so on. If you take a look at where we've ended up, not just in the number of people that are in prison or jail on any given day, but with the fact that 100 million Americans now have a criminal record on file, you have to ask yourself, how did we get here? And I would argue, luckily, it's such a recent phenomena, as devastating as it's become, that the research it takes to figure out how we got here and how we get out is really at our fingertips.
Now, there's 2.3 million people in jail currently. How many are also under probation or control?
5.6, an additional 5.6 million are under some other form of criminal justice supervision.
What does this cost us as a country?
$80 billion a year. And that's just the cost of prisons. Yeah. That's not even including the cost of police departments and courts and all the other ancillary parts of the criminal justice system.
Not to mention the opportunity cost of the people who are in prison and what that's costing society.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you care about human capital, there's a lot of it wasting away in prison. I'd love to tell a story, if we have the time, about someone I met in prison and what it means to have a person like that locked up based on the sort of human capital he brings to the table.
Tell us now.
Sure. I was in New York State. When you move from one prison to the other, sometimes it can take 3 days to move a person on a trip that might take 10 hours for someone who's driving upstate New York. And you stop off in different prisons. And I was held at Auburn Correctional Facility, which is, you know, I want the viewers to think of the most antiquated version of a prison they might be able to imagine, with, you know, dark walls and tall guard towers and so on. And I get into a cell, and we know we're there for 3 days because I got there on a Friday, and the correction officers opened up the windows so that it would become really cold in the cells. And it was the middle of winter in New York, so it ended up being about 45 degrees in that cell. And by the second day, I began to catch a cold, and he said to me, would you like me to make you a cup of tea? And here we are trapped in this cell together, and I just sort of laughed and said,
how?
Sure, Arthur, go ahead, make me a cup of tea. And he grabs a plastic bottle and fills it with water and uses a string to tie the bottle to the light fixture in the cell, and then lights a small flame using the toilet tissue and a lead pencil in that cell. And the bottle began to spin and the water began to boil, and he ripped open the collar of his prison outfit and grabbed a tea bag and put it in that bottle and made me a cup of tea. And I hold on to that story because I think you don't get to the point where you criminalize 100 million people until you've dehumanized them first. And I think we forget, because of the labels we use to refer to people in prison, convict, inmate, prisoner, and so on, that they are also fathers and mothers and uncles and sisters and brothers. And so when I think about trying to get to a tipping point on this issue, I think part of it is the policy, which I just mentioned, but another big part of it is Americans getting to the point where they say, this is not how we treat other human beings.
Yeah, an incredibly resourceful guy, no question about that. You think what he could be doing on the outside. Well, picking up on that a little bit, you've said that if we don't get to the issues that undergird this criminal justice system, we're never going to get to the bottom of this and create meaningful reform. We'll be tinkering around the edges forever. What are those issues, and do you think we're getting to them?
Sure. So, I mean, if you there's a bipartisan coalition that's been formed over the last few years that's taking a look at our criminal justice system and how we got here. And I put some stock in that, maybe not as much as my colleagues, because it really was a bipartisan coalition that got us here. I think that gets lost on some folks that progressives were just as guilty in getting us here as more conservative folks. And I come to believe in my career, I've been doing this now for almost 16 years since exiting prison, and that elected officials are vehicles to change policy, but they're not leaders with respect to taking the sort of risk it takes to get us out of the mess that we've gotten ourselves into. In fact, I can't think of anyone else who has the least appetite for risk than an elected official.
You're absolutely right.
And so the question is, how do you motivate them? And the question is, how do you get their constituency to demand something different from them? And so we at Just Leadership USA spend a lot of our time investing in formerly incarcerated people as storytellers, partially, because we believe that the more people are willing to stand up and put the stigma aside, which is a big part of how we got here, and be able to tell their stories, the more other folks simply come out of the closet, for lack of a better term. And you get enough people to come out of the closet and say, I've been locked up and I'm still a human being and I have a family and I care about this and that, is the closer I think we get to getting elected officials to say, wait a minute, there might be a win here. And I think the Close Rikers campaign, which I know we'll talk about momentarily, we'll give you a sense of what that really looks like.
Well, speaking of time, you spent 7 years incarcerated in New York State prisons, Rikers Island, first for 2 days and then for a year. And I think the last six or so was at the Wyoming Correctional Facility up by Attica. Tell us your story about how you got there and what it was like in prison.
Sure. So I was arrested at the age of 16 in New York City for shoplifting the first time I wound up at Rikers. And that's the 2 day stint that you're referring to. You know, they call this place Gladiator School. It really is it really is the epitome of everything that's wrong with our criminal justice system. On day two, on my way back to court, I was stabbed 4 times in a cell. And on Rikers, you get stabbed 4 times in a cell in the middle of a fight. You actually emerge from that fight knowing you've made a name for yourself and that you can survive there at the age of 16. But what was more difficult was the correction officers in the background laughing and snickering and letting me know that if I sought medical help, that I'd be labeled a snitch and I wouldn't be able to survive at Rikers. So, it's referred to as Gladiator School back then. It's still referred to that way now. And the way to survive at Gladiator School is to be a gladiator. I was subsequently arrested again for robbery and found myself back at Rikers. And the thing about Rikers, when you're going across that bridge to this penal colony, is you recognize that the only way to survive violence on Rikers is to be violent on Rikers. And so I became part of that culture for a year to survive. And then I got to state prison. It's funny, at my sentencing, the prosecutor said to the judge, you know, Your Honor, Mr. Martin will never be anything beyond a criminal, and you should give him way more than these 6 years that you're about to give him. And he never looked up. He never looked sideways. He looked down at my rap sheet the entire time. A month later, a correction counselor in prison said to me, Glenn, you should go to college. And, you know, you sort of juxtapose those two things, right? Like, people ask, how do we end mass incarceration? I would argue that that person who said to me, you should go to college, actually did a lot to invest in
ending. Was that the first time you ever heard that?
It was the first time anyone had ever said that to me. I grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, back when it was a tough place to live. Think of places like Fort Greene, Brooklyn. It was a lot more Fort when I was a kid, a lot less Green. But it was, you know, I grew up in a tough neighborhood where even our school counselors told us we wouldn't go to college. And here I am in prison. Someone tells me to go to college. And I end up earning a 2-year quality liberal arts degree while I'm in prison, which obviously was a huge turnaround moment for me.
Yeah.
And so I emerged from prison strangely, you know, just wanting to get a job and pay off all these fines and fees and restitution and all these other financial costs that I accumulated while I was in prison, and landed at a public interest law firm. And that's the beginning of the story of my advocacy work.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting when you left prison, too. You said, you know, looking at all the cell phones on the street, you were just absolutely blown away on just, I guess, being in sort of a gray, dingy place and then just having all the colors and all the pageantry of the outside hit you between your eyes.
Yeah, you know, that gets lost on people. The longer you actually lock people up, not just the more disconnected they are from community and family and the things that allow us to thrive, but things as small as, you know, the advancement in technology. I mean, think about it. If you were locked up for the last 20 years, like, good luck, right? I mean, you can't even be a janitor or a porter without being able to order supplies on the computer.
Right. Even silence kind of spooked you, right?
Oh, silence continues to spook me. I turn on CNN at night, and sometimes I wake up the next morning and CNN is still blasting, and that is actually a comfortable way for me to sleep. Why? Because I spent 6 years sleeping in a prison setting with constant noise all throughout the day and throughout the night.
Well, if you ever need to be reminded that going to prison can sometimes be a life sentence, it was certainly brought home to you a couple years ago when you went to visit the White House. Tell us that story.
Sure. So, you know, you do advocacy work for 13, 14 years, and one day you get a call saying there's a chance to go to the White House and talk to some of the senior policy advisors to the President of the United States. That becomes the culmination of all your work. And so I go to D.C. and I'm walking over to the White House with a bunch of colleagues. Actually, there were about 50 of us all together. And I was walking over with a prosecutor from Georgia, and we were chatting about the various programs he had in place to stop young people from further penetrating the criminal justice system. And we get to the White House, and we both hand in our driver's license, and he gets a green pass like everyone else ahead of him, and I get a pink pass that says needs escort. Mm-hmm. And you literally have to put this around your neck. So talk about scarlet letter. And so I walk through security, multiple levels of security, and I get to the end, and a Secret Service agent leans over and says, you can't enter the White House. So I stand there for about 35 minutes trying to get in contact with someone in the meeting to come downstairs and, quote, escort me to this meeting with Valerie Jarrett and Roy Austin and other folks. And 35 minutes into it, the door behind him flies open, and a young white female intern grabs me and takes me in. And we get to the elevator about 100 feet away, and she says, you're Mr. Davidson, right? I'm so sorry you had to wait. And I said, no, my name is Mr. Martin, but please do not take me back. Please take me to the meeting. And she did. And as you can imagine, it was a moment where I had to make a decision about whether I would disturb that meeting in the way that I thought made sense and really highlight what it was like to be one of the underclass of citizenship that we have in this country. And on my way back to New York, decided to write a letter to President Obama. And by the end of that trip, decided that it needed to be an open letter and shared it with the Wall Street Journal. And it was meant to send a statement to a White House that was run by a black president that said that mass incarceration has not worked, that they had a problem in their own backyard, if you will, and that while I recognize that tons of formerly incarcerated people are not being invited to the White House, that what does this mean for the person who's leaving prison on that day trying to get a job down, you know, at McDonald's? And so, you know, I think it made a real statement. I got invited back to the White House, had a chance to have a one-on-one with President Obama. Mm-hmm. And had a chance to tell him, you know, obviously thank him for some of the things he was doing on this issue, but also hold him accountable for other things that I thought that he needed to be doing.
That's a very powerful story. Let me ask you this, Glenn. You know, if you're a victim of a crime, I think the first thing you want instinctively is to have the perpetrator punished. But then after that, you always say, and I hope that person never does it to anybody else again. Yet we have a system where 2 out of 3 of them will. So the question is, why does society continue to invest in that very same system, which has such an impeccable track record of failure?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think what victims want really matter. But I think what also matters is how we define victims in this country. The data from the federal government tells us that young black men are the most prevalent victims of violent crime in this country. And yet that is not the picture we have in our minds when we hear the word victim. And so that means that the victims that are at the table telling a story about what we should be doing to perpetrators of crime doesn't match the reality of victimization in this country. And those people's voices are important. But I think if we're going to be intellectually honest, then every stakeholder needs to be at the table. So I think part of it is that we're not telling the truth about how our criminal justice system is constructed. If you look at the foundation, the values that drive our criminal justice system, punitiveness and punishment, and the fact that our criminal justice system emerged at the end of the civil rights era proper, if you will, that tells a more accurate story about how we ended up here. This is has little to do with right and wrong and good and evil and deserving and not deserving. This has a lot to do with controlling a segment of the American population in a way that responded to us believing that we had lost some control with the victories of the civil rights era. So if you look at the four E's, employment, education, equality, enfranchisement, the things that we fought for during the civil rights era, those things have been eviscerated for Americans, for people who have criminal records. And it's a legitimate discrimination, right? We call it criminal record-based discrimination, but it obviously serves as a surrogate for race and class-based discrimination. So I think until our criminal justice system revisits those values and looks at things like second chances and redemption and transformation and opportunity, we're going to continue to have a criminal justice system that rhetorically talks about those things, but in practice actually turns out more victimization than any other policy that we have in place in the United States.
A complete change of mindset. People talk about a prison industrial complex in this country, you know, an economic engine that continues to feed itself. How extensive is it and how big an influence do you think it plays in our criminal justice system?
You know, on my way out of prison after serving 6 years, a correction officer who I had developed a relationship with in a very casual conversation with me, he said to me, he said, "You know, Glenn, you being here helped me get my boat. And when your son gets here, he's going to help my son get his boat."
Oh, wow.
And it was difficult to hear that, but I carry it with me throughout my career because it reminds me that the most successful economic stimulus program in this country is prisons in rural communities all across America. And that as we have a discussion about ending mass incarceration, we need to be having, one, a simultaneous discussion about the economics of our criminal justice system and who benefits. I mean, I have an older brother who himself benefits, I would argue, from our criminal justice system. We can talk about that. But then also, if we're only having the conversation in the silo of the criminal justice reform community, then, again, we're not responding to how we actually got here. The fact of the matter is that there are so many public health issues that the public health sector has turned itself away from that are now dealt with by our prisons, that if the public health sector is not involved, then we're not having a real discussion about addiction, about mental health. If folks who do housing work are not involved, then we're not having a conversation about homelessness and how we've criminalized that. There's so many other sectors, education, economic development, workforce development, you name it, that need to be at the table to get us out of this mess. And it's why I think we need to be extremely intellectually honest about how we got here. Otherwise, if we use the rhetoric of the system to try to get ourselves out of this mess, we're going to find ourselves spinning our wheels, including the way we refer to people in prison. I would argue that words like prisoner, convict, inmate, offender are all words meant to other people in the system. And until we use words that are more humanizing, that we say stuck in that cycle of how do you treat an inmate? Well, you know, it's a lot easier to lock an inmate in a cell for 23 hours a day than a father.
Yeah. So sounds to me that prison in some ways has become the repository of all the other failed systems of society.
That's absolutely true. And when policymakers, both progressive and conservative, have these risk-averse conversations about who's deserving of being in prison and who shouldn't, including candidate Hillary Clinton, who talked about, yes, mass incarceration's horrible and we need to get those nonviolent marijuana offenders out of prison. Like, guess what? That low-hanging fruit was taken care of a long time ago.
Yeah.
And that's just not how we got here. The fact is that we've ratcheted up punishment for every single person involved in the criminal justice system. And so to get out of this mess, guess what? We're going to have a real conversation about people who were arrested and convicted of even violent crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't get there, you can let go every single person in prison today who was convicted of a nonviolent crime, and you'd still have mass incarceration.
Absolutely. Well, you started Just Leadership USA back in late 2014, and you have a number of bold initiatives, one that you referred to already, and that is a campaign to close Rikers Island. Tell us what goes on at Rikers Island and the case that you're making to the mayor and other political leaders as to why it should be closed.
You know, 16 months ago, when I first said out loud that we should close Rikers, it was a very lonely place to be. Rikers Island is a piece of land in New York City. It started as 82 acres, purchased from the Ryken family. There was a judge in the Ryken family who sold it to the city of New York, who would capture free black men and return them to slavery in the South. And so I don't want that history of Rikers to get lost in this conversation. I actually think that insidious seed of history is important to where we ended up. So today it is an island that has 10 jails. It's a penal colony. It's in line with all of our mistakes during mass incarceration. It's grown to 420 acres. Mm-hmm. It is now 200 feet away from LaGuardia Airport. I bring that up because the airport creates a flight path that allows us to build buildings that are literally antithetical to how you'd build a safe jail. Safe jails are podular. Rikers Island is linear and flat. Mm-hmm. We spend $247,000 per bed per year to lock people up.
$250,000.
Yeah. 80% of the people are not convicted of a crime. They're just detained. 89% people of color in a city where 56% of the population are people of color. So it's the perfect storm of abuse every day. There's an article about abuse at Rikers Island. I'm not exaggerating. And so you would think that our progressive mayor, Mayor de Blasio, would have immediately saw how this island fits in with his messaging about a tale of two cities. The fact that there are a group of New Yorkers that are treated heavily differently than other New Yorkers. And on Rikers, simply because you can't afford bail, you sit there and you're exposed to the chance of being hurt or killed. And that is not an exaggeration. And we have other jails in New York. We have smaller jails in the boroughs. Granted, those places need to be rebuilt also. Mm-hmm. But they're nowhere near as violent as Rikers Island. And part of it is culture. There is a culture that exists at Rikers Island that is about the history, which I just mentioned. It's about the remoteness of the island, and it's about not holding staff accountable for their behavior and also not providing opportunity to the people who are there detained. And so we launched this campaign, and even the people who supported us and gave us the funding to do it as a nonprofit gave us a 20% chance of convincing the mayor in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And yet in less than a year, we got the mayor to change his mind. Why? Because we made the investment in people who had been most harmed by Rikers. We did not start with elected officials. We did not start with other opinion leaders. We started with the people that had the most stake in the outcome of our campaign. And, you know, we're nowhere near the finish line. The mayor wants to take a decade to do it.
10-year timeline, right.
Yeah.
Not happy about that.
Not happy at all. I mean, Empire State Building was built in 12 months and 45 days. And so if you can build a building like that in a year and a month, one might argue you can do a better job of closing Rikers in less than a decade. And I think that this speaks to his disconnect between his rhetoric and his practice. And we're gonna hold this mayor just as accountable as we'd hold the president accountable in D.C. for what's happening there. And what I think gets lost on people is, you know, with all the rhetoric coming out of D.C. these days and what feels like archaic sort of throwback policy, if you will, the fact of the matter is on this particular issue, 90% of the people in cages in America are there on the state and local level.
What's the one thing you would like the mayor to do at this point in time?
You know, I think the mayor should stop relying on Wall Street folks to tell him how to end the violence at Rikers and how to close the place down. I think he should realize that the community itself, people who have been harmed by Rikers, have actually done a lot of thinking about what we can do differently in this city to achieve public safety. So I'd first like to see him open up the door to have a meaningful conversation with the Close Rikers campaign and with the people who drove him to make this decision in the first place. Second thing I'd like to see him do is to use his political capital to change policy.
He's been reluctant to do that.
He has. He actually, again, has talked about the importance of this issue, particularly at the point where we got him to relent and agree with us. But he has yet to talk about what he's going to do with respect to speedy trial, bail reform, and discovery reform. We have people sitting at Rikers in some cases for 6-7 years waiting for trial.
I think the average has gone from 100 days to 200 days in 10 years.
The punishment is in the process.
Yeah.
Whether you're found innocent or not, you've already been punished if you spent 100 days on Rikers.
You know, you mentioned in the opening that another one of your audacious goals is to cut the population, the prison population, by half by 2030. How did you arrive at that 50% reduction as a target, and what are your plans for getting there?
Sure. There's two reasons. One is after coming out of prison and doing really great work, particularly around the consequences of criminal convictions, barriers to employment, housing, education, and so on, I realized that for me to be honest, you know, to the people I left behind, the people who I believe are still suffering in our criminal justice system, that I needed to inspire the field to be bolder and more audacious. And so once I decided to go out and launch my own organization, I wanted the goal to allow me to wake up with a sense of urgency every day, but also inspire the field to think more boldly. And we see evidence of that. I mean, the ACLU has the same goal of cutting the correctional population in half in this country. And I would like to take some credit, my team and I, for inspiring the field to think more boldly, first of all. Second of all, I have a child, Joshua, who was 3 years old when I first launched this organization, and he's going to be 18 in 2030. And your viewers might not know that 1 in 3 black children born today are going to go to prison in our country if we continue to lock people up at the rate we do now. And I needed a reason to wake up every morning hell-bent on getting rid of mass incarceration and saving Joshua's life. And so those two things inspired me to have this bold and audacious goal of trying to get to half by 2030. And the Close Rikers campaign is a solid sort of example of that. People hear half by 2030 and they think that it's so daunting that they don't really understand how we get there or whether Just Leadership is focused on the policy decisions that need to be made. But you can't close Rikers without cutting the population in half. When I was at Rikers, there were 22,000 people. Today, there are 8,000 people. So we know that we have already cut the population in half. And the question is just, can we do it again very deliberately to get to the finish line? And the hope is that if you close a place like Rikers, you actually inspire people all across the country to themselves think more boldly. So I don't think Just Leadership is in any jeopardy of solving this problem alone, but I hope that we can inspire other people to think as boldly as we do.
Well, Rikers is a wonderful symbol because it really is represents almost every jail in this country in so many different ways. You have developed some leadership programs for the formerly incarcerated, which I know is a big part of your strategy, so they really can step into this issue and create a movement to change the system. What are some of those programs and what impact have you seen from the fellows who've gone through them?
Sure. So we have two trainings. One is a year-long training. It's called Leading with Conviction. It's a competitive opportunity. We get about 150 applicants for 36 slots, very coveted slots. But we make a very heavy investment in these leaders. They come to New York a few times per year. They stay with us for weekends, very rigorous 10-hour days, followed by networking dinners where we've had the Secretary of State, we've had the head of Bureau of Justice Assistance. We've had Darren Walker, who I know has been a guest on your show, the head of the Ford Foundation, join us. And the idea is, earlier you said people closest to the problem are closest to the solution, something that we often say, but we also say, but furthest from power and resources. Mm-hmm. And so we invest in them as leaders, but we try to bring them closer in proximity to the people who can give them access to decision makers, or they themselves are decision makers or funders to actually fund their work, which is actually important. I mean, to get to the finish line, to close Rikers, it took a pretty generous gift from a donor who believed that they could eliminate suffering at Rikers Island. So in between the in-person seminars, we do topical webinars. We do a 360 assessment on both sides to measure the impact of the training. And then we have a shorter training called Emerging Leaders, which we move around the country because we recognize that the year-long training is really competitive, difficult to get into, lasts for a year, and we want to really build community. And so we decided that we needed to have a training that created a pipeline for the year-long Leading with Conviction training. So altogether, we've trained about 370 formerly incarcerated leaders in 28 states plus D.C. And so it gives us a footprint around the country of leaders who bring with them constituents who care about a criminal justice system that's smaller, fairer, and more humane.
You know, to be an effective advocacy group, you have to create an effective infrastructure. So how have you gone about building Just Leadership USA? What's your thinking been, and where do you get your funding from?
Sure. So, you know, I have the benefit of having learned the business of nonprofit, working at the Legal Action Center, which was my first job out of prison, and then being a vice president at a place called the Fortune Society, a reentry organization here in New York. And, you know, I think that part of the work gets lost on folks who have a vision for reform. And unfortunately, it is a real important part of getting the work done. You have to build infrastructure. So the first thing is not engaging in mission creep, like knowing who you are and who you're not, you know, deciding what your mission is and not straying from it. even in the toughest of times. You know, being willing to run an organization that shrinks in size when the funding is not there on the issue you care about, but holding on to what it is you care about and being relentless.
Don't follow the money and get a mission creep as a result.
Absolutely, absolutely. And beyond that, building the organization very deliberately. I mean, we have actually turned down resources when we thought it would take us in the wrong direction. But being methodical, I mean, we are running an organization that has such a bold and audacious goal, and because the investment is in the people most harmed, we've actually benefited from people paying attention to what it is that we're doing. In the beginning, it was really tough because people couldn't wrap their heads around how you go from half by 2030 to concreteness like the Close Rikers campaign. And I think that's starting to gel for some folks. But I tend to hire people who are a whole lot smarter than me and give them the space to do their work and the space to make mistakes. And that has worked out very well for me, recognizing that when you bring on that sort of talent, it probably means that they won't be there forever. I've already, you know, had turnover in staff. People tend to stay a year and a half, 2 years, and that sort of is the most you can get in this labor market these days. But I've built an organization where that institutional history gets captured and passed on to new incoming, really intelligent, smart, thoughtful, strategic folks.
Let me ask you one more thing about half by 2030. You know, there was a story in the New York Times recently entitled "Opioid Users Are Filling Up the Jails." What is happening here, and what do you think should be happening here, and how concerned are you about that?
Sure. Well, as somebody who lived through the crack epidemic and saw a very different response, I actually am hopeful about what's happening here. So obviously, there are lives and families and communities being decimated by this opioid addiction issue. And I know what that looks like because I've seen, you know, I saw my own community of Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, destroyed. I remember a gentleman who lived down the block from me who didn't get money from his mom to buy crack. And so he went to the gas station and bought gasoline and lit her on fire. And so I know what sort of harm can be caused by these addiction issues. At the same time, this issue is affecting a population that looks a lot different than the folks who were affected during the crack epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a white middle-class population, a white poor population, but a white population, and mm-hmm. one that policymakers can look at and see hope in. And that means that their responses, I think, on the whole, look a lot different. It looks like much more of a public health response to this issue, which is right where we want to land. And so while I recognize that on the local level, jails are being inundated with arrests for people who are caught with these drugs, but I think we also need to look at the outcome of those cases and recognize that they look a lot different than when it was black and brown folks getting locked up for possession of crack cocaine and for addiction to crack cocaine. And so in some ways, that makes me hopeful that the public health sector will again decide that these folks belong to them and come in and help folks in the criminal justice space, folks who are really ill-equipped to deal with this, to understand the distinction between addiction and criminal intent.
Mm-hmm. You know, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but your older brother was a corrections officer, and he's now a U.S. Marshal, and your dad was a police officer. So you look at this issue through some different lenses. How have those different perspectives helped inform your work?
Well, first of all, you can imagine what Thanksgiving is like at my place.
Well, all our Thanksgivings are like that these days, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know, my older brother went into the military at age 17. And if you look at the trajectory of all three of us, you can sort of see where opportunity injected itself and changed the trajectory of our lives. I would bet that my older brother would have went to prison just like my younger brother and myself had he not gone into the military and been exposed to different countries, different people, different religions, different backgrounds, and so on. And he came out of the military and became a federal correction officer for almost a decade, and now he's a U.S. Marshal. And he and I have had conversations in the past that remind me that he was taken out of poverty and propelled into middle class as a result of his opportunity to work within this criminal justice system. And in particular, what stands out for me is the way he justifies his role in that job and how he doesn't take ownership over the system as a whole, but instead rationalizes mm-hmm. that if he's not the one causing harm, then, you know, I'm not the one who got these people locked up. And as long as I'm not hurting them, then I'm just doing my job.
Yep.
And well, guess what? There's 3 million Americans who also benefit from this system. And I think until those folks inject some broader understanding of what the implications are of believing in a system like this, we actually don't get to the finish line. And that's something we need to reckon with as a country, that a huge segment of our labor market and our stock market these days, with the privatization of not just prisons, but probation and even reentry services, social services, that is a lobby that we have created for punishment. And we have figured out how to monetize misery. And until we reckon with that and we engage those folks and figure out how to retrain people and help them understand that there are other jobs that lend themselves to a stronger country, I don't think we get to the finish line. And the fact that people like me, who are from families where some people went to prison and some people work in the criminal justice system, which plays out in poor white families also, I think that sort of proximity, I think proximity is important, as Brian Stevenson would say.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sort of proximity where you have that sort of distinction within families, hopefully will create the kind of dialogue that'll get us to the finish line.
You know, there are few things that are more difficult than trying to change a culture, particularly one as deeply ingrained as a criminal justice system. What have you learned, and I'm sure you're continuing to learn, about how to effectively go about changing a culture?
Human beings respond to what you measure, what you tell them you care about. Right now, we measure all the wrong things, even recidivism, the rate at which people return to prison. You know, I worked at a reentry program where we did our best to provide services to people to help them get jobs and housing and education and so on. I remember one day we realized that our young folks, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, gang members, would walk to the corner and get on the subway and get arrested at alarming rates, and we couldn't understand why. And so we pulled a couple of them aside, and it turned out that they were dropping their Metro cards once there was no cash left on it on the subway floor, or spitting on the subway floor. And these young rookie NYPD officers would grab them and say, "Give me your ID from the social service program you're coming from." And we couldn't understand why they were doing that, except in New York, for those sort of violations, if you don't have a previous conviction, you get a ticket and you go home.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a previous felony, you go to jail. And so those officers knew that if you made an arrest towards the end of your shift, you could rack up overtime hours by locking these folks up. And there were all these young high school students coming down the other end of the subway, and they wouldn't touch them. And guess what? They would do the same things. I mean, I would argue I've done the same thing in the subway. And so I just want to be clear that, you know, if you measure the wrong things, and then you get the kind of outcomes that we see now, where in that case, you have no control over recidivism if people are being targeted. So I think we need to measure things like opportunity, like, you know, are people, you know, how many less people are we locking up? How many people are we connecting to services and training and housing? And I live in New York City, and I've lived here all my life. And if you go down Fifth Avenue from some of the worst communities, and then you get to 96th Street, and things change. Things change considerably. Things get pretty damn safe. And you have to ask yourself, what's the distinction? Because in Harlem and the Bronx, what you see is NYPD guard towers. You see officers on patrol. You see parole officers, probation officers. You see all the things that we tell ourselves lend themselves to public safety. And then you get to 96th Street, and you see better schools and better housing and better education and better health care.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, those are the things that actually help us to achieve public safety. And as a country, I think that we've convinced each other of this mass incarceration system that we all have sort of come to believe in. And, you know, the most difficult part of Half by 2030 for us as an organization is to get people to use their imagination to imagine something a lot different.
Well, let me close with this, Glenn. You are optimistic about this struggle and believe that you and others in this fight are going to prevail because we have reached a tipping point of sorts. Why do you think we have reached that tipping point?
Because people who have been harmed by our criminal justice system are no longer willing to allow the stigma of that conviction to get in the way of having their voices heard. And I think that when, you know, there's two things you can organize in this country. You can organize money and you can organize people. And when 100 million people are affected by an issue and more they see people being willing to speak out about the harm that was caused to them, I think that is the sort of momentum that can't be stopped. The fact of the matter is that a system that distinguishes victims from offenders, when the truth is that I didn't learn how to pull out a gun on someone until someone pulled out a gun on me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the case for many people who end up in the criminal justice system, except when they're victims of crime, they're not deserving victims. But when they're offenders, we're ready to spend $250,000 to lock them up. I think those days are over. I think those days are over because the 100 million Americans are no longer willing to sit back and own the stigma and live in the shadows and the shame of having been involved in the criminal justice system. And that is something that even our president won't be able to stop.
Well said. Well, Glenn E. Martin, the founder and president of Just Leadership USA, I want to thank you for being here this evening for a most informative and interesting conversation. For listeners who want to learn more about your organization or become engaged in this work in some fashion, even helping support it, where's your website and what's on it?
Sure. If people go to justleadershipusa.org, there's a chance to donate to support the organization or become a member. And if you're in New York and you're interested in the Close Rikers campaign, visit closerikers.org. And again, there are ways for people to get engaged beyond just financial support, also being involved in the actual policy advocacy and organizing work that it takes to continue to hold the mayor accountable.
Well, thanks, Glenn. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.